Well, good evening. Thank you for coming. We are in Micah, looking at Micah chapter 1. We'll probably get through all of this chapter, we'll see. You can see on your notes there's three sections. The first section of the chapter 1, besides chapter 1, verse 1, the introduction, there's chapter 1, verses 2 through 8. And I got this, or 2 through 7. I got that at the top of the page there with some introductory notes. And that's the first section where basically it's going to be an announcement of the coming judgment. Of God is announcing the judgment that is coming. And then, interestingly, in chapter 1, verses 8 through 9, it's Micah's response. Which is interesting because you've got Micah making an announcement for God, actually pronouncing God's words, as if he's hearing them for the first time. Because in verses 8 and 9, he's taken back by it. He goes into some kind of like a mourning. So it really, in an interesting way, it's not like Micah is looking, as we might look at culture today and say, you know, this is not good, things are happening bad, and there's surely judgment coming. That's kind of like our analyzing the situation. So we perceive the situation, we anticipate what the judgment will be like, and it might be bad, but, you know, it's pretty obvious. Where Micah seems to talk about, you know, and he pronounces God's judgment, and then in verses 8 and 9, he's like shocked by it. I was like, my gosh, this is unbelievable. And then in verses 10 through 16, we're going to go through a series of cities. There's going to be 11 cities mentioned here in the Shephelah that are going to be overrun. And a 12th city, if we count Jerusalem, and we'll take a look at that. You can actually see that on the very back page, just so you can get a look. This is where we're going to head there, those last verses, 10 through 15, 10 through 16. And they're mentioned in that order, 1 through 11, starting with Gath. And I've got them located down there in the Shephelah, where they're all located. Now, do understand, as we get into those, the ones that are in the white circle, 2, 4, 5, and 6, no one knows where they're at. No one knows exactly where those cities are at. But based on the other locations that are clearly identifiable, they're probably in that same lowland place in the hill country. And it's going to be a site of some invasions that take place during what we'd say the 8th century or the 700s. So the timing of this that we're looking at here tonight, and I will add this too, this is chapter 1 that we're going to be talking about. It appears chapter 1 and 3 are given at the same time as far as where they're at in this. This is Micah's window. He prophesied during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And we know that his words spoken during this time period before Hezekiah or during Hezekiah's reign because of Jeremiah, that Hezekiah took action and the people responded to Amos. So there is some kind of repentance that takes place before Sennacherib arrives, apparently, in Jerusalem. So when is this chapter taking place? We know this for sure. It's before 722. 722 is when Samaria falls. Samaria has not fallen yet because he's still talking about the judgment that's coming. Also, it's going to mention high places right away. The high places were cleaned up by Hezekiah. So it's, again, that fits this. It's going to be before the days of Hezekiah, which is, again, back here. But Ahaz was known for, Hezekiah's father, Ahaz was known and even recorded of setting up high places, which is a perversion of Yahweh worship. It's combining pagan worship with Yahweh worship. He's setting up some kind of, you know, Asherah poles and all kinds of compromises, including not just worshiping in the temple, but worshiping in multiple places. And many of these places are still seen today. That you can, as excavation has taken place, they found the high places. So it's easy to think that it's going to be before 722, so it'd be after 735. So between 735 and 722, I would say a safe guess would be around 730 B.C., right around that time. It's before the fall of Samaria. They can feel the pressure of the Assyrians, and the high places are in full function. Again, that's just kind of an estimate of when this all takes place, when these are being prophesied. And that would cover chapters 1, 2, and 3, potentially. And that's kind of a timing of when it's going to take place and what is going to be involved. And now, we'll begin in chapter 1, verse 1. I'll just read it. We've looked at this before. The word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, the vision he saw concerned Samaria and Jerusalem. And so those are the two capital cities, Samaria and Jerusalem. You could call the northern Israel the land of Samaria also, but I think we're talking about the capital cities. And the reason it's going to be focused on the capital cities is going to be because, most likely, is the sin that's affecting the countries, the northern Israel and Judah, is coming from these cities. The sin that the prophets of the 8th century, the 700s, if it be Amos, Micah, Hosea, Isaiah, all kind of contemporaries, Amos being first, they had basically two sins, and you're going to see them in here in this book very clearly. It's going to be social injustice, and we talked about that before, where the wealthy people, those with the wealth, those with the power, those with the leadership, are going to begin to oppress those who are not as fortunate. And we're not talking about the homeless again, we're talking about the middle class. We're talking about those who have homes. They have nice homes. They've worked for them. They've got jobs. They've got business. They've received inheritance that's been handed down to them. And now corruption has set in, and these people, the wealthy, the powerful, the leaders, including the priesthood, is going to start crushing in courts and illegally and by stealing from the middle class, and they're going to become the poor. So when we talk about the poor in the 700s, we're not talking about the homeless. We're talking about those whose society has widened the gap and have turned them into slaves. They've stolen their property. They've stolen their businesses, and they're getting wealthy. So the prophets, Isaiah, Amos, Micah, Hosea, all will address social injustice at this time. And the next thing that's obviously going to be part of it is going to be idolatry. Idolatry is probably the cause of this. You get false religion, you're going to get false justice. You're going to get perversion in the justice. And this idolatry is not just straight up Baal worship. Again, I think I've got it written there. On point 3 at the top of page 1. The sin addressed by the prophets of the 700s BCs, Amos, Micah, Hosea, Isaiah, was social injustice and then idolatry. And idolatry, I think you should think about it this way. It's perverted worship with a twisted theology. So it's worship of God, but the theology is off-center. It's twisted. They're overemphasizing one thing, neglecting another thing. So they think they're got solid theology. They think they're in the truth, but it's twisted. It's not balanced. You know, for example, God is good. He never does anything bad. He doesn't sin, but sometimes God does things that we would call bad that we don't want to take place. God will bring judgment. Well, that's not very nice. So, I mean, that would be an example of twisted. He will never bring judgment because he can only love and be compassionate. Well, a balanced theology, he is truth. He is truth, and truth sometimes needs to bring justice. But a perverted worship with a twisted theology that still claim the name of the Lord, these people in this idolatry have not, we saw that in Amos, they have not necessarily walked away from the name of Yahweh. They haven't walked away from what Moses introduced them to. They've kept the name of Yahweh. It says they still claim the name of the Lord while holding to some Mosaic rituals, meaningless rituals, but they still got their traditions, along with some pagan religious practices. So they brought in a pagan theology, which has warped the truth. They maintain the name of Yahweh, but they've also brought in, along with that, some rituals of the pagans, could include some kind of sacrifices. And so these are the two sins. And what we're going to see, the social justice will be very clear. The idolatry tonight, we're going to see it mentioned as high places, but it also is going to be mentioned as prostitution or prostitutes. And so we'll look at that verse when we get there. It may be talking about prostitution, or prostitutes, it may be talking about a religion that should be faithful to the Lord, but it's prostituted itself into idolatry. So those are the two sins, and Samaria and Jerusalem are the targets because that's the center. Samaria, though, is going to be destroyed in 722, so Samaria is going to fall. There's no recovery. But even in these verses tonight, we don't know exactly the situation, but Jerusalem, Judah is going to crumble. It's going to be overrun by the Assyrians, by Sennacherib, coming in 701. This is Sargon is doing this, Sennacherib's father. But then in 701, Sennacherib comes down, as we know, into Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, they're right up to the gates of Jerusalem. They're talking over the walls to Hezekiah and his men. And then the 185,000 are destroyed. And Jerusalem is spared. And as we saw in the book of Jeremiah, it is likely that Micah simply announced the judgment that was coming to northern Israel, but his words penetrated Hezekiah and Jerusalem at that time, and there's some kind of repentance. You can see Hezekiah has a heart for God, and even Jeremiah and the people of Jeremiah's day recognized that Micah had an impact on Hezekiah. And so the reason I say that is, well, when we get to this invasion that we're talking about here at the end of the chapter, I will refer to that again. I put on here Micah is speaking most likely in Jerusalem at this time. So here I go. I'm going to read through chapter 1, and you're going to see three parts in here. You're going to see the judgment that's announced to Samaria and Jerusalem. And do notice right away in verse 3, or verse 2, that the earth, the nations are called to witness. They're called. We'll refer to this again if I go back to my notes. The earth and nations are addressed first, and they are called to witness, either be a witness or to observe. I think it's a teaching moment. The nations are called to watch and learn, because God, the God of the heavens, the God of the universe, the God of creation, is going to judge God's people. God's people, Israel, is going to come under judgment. And God is going to judge His people, and the nations are there to watch, not because they're innocent, but for just a flat-out demonstration. My people have disobeyed me. You're not even close. You're not even trying. But my people have disobeyed me. I am going to bring judgment on them. Understand, your day is coming. I think it's very clear. Your day is coming. The nations will be judged, not now. Just like Peter says in 1 Peter, judgment begins with the household of God. And God is judging them, but He calls the nations to watch this and learn, because I'm not going to let you escape. I'm just not messing with you right now. I'm dealing with my own people here. And so that's how chapter 1, verse 2 begins. Here it is. Hear, O people, all of you. Listen, O earth, and all who are in it, that the sovereign Lord, again, there's Yahweh, may witness against you, the Lord from His holy temple. In other words, this is my testimony to you. I'm witnessing. This is what I'm going to do. So now you've got evidence that I'm going to be the judge. We'll come back to this. Verse 3. Now here's His announcement. Again, you're going to see God moving from heaven into the earth. If He's sitting on the throne in heaven with His feet in Jerusalem, however you want to picture it, if He's moving from the temple to the earth, if He's moving from the temple in Jerusalem out into the community, however you're going to picture it, the Lord is coming down. And it says He's in His holy temple. And then in verse 3, look, the Lord is coming from His dwelling place. He comes down and treads the high places, there's an important word, of the earth. The mountains melt beneath Him, and the valleys split apart, like wax before the fire, like water rushing down a slope. All this is because of Jacob's transgression, because of the sins of the house of Israel. What is Jacob's transgression? Is it not Samaria? What is Judah's high place? Is it not Jerusalem? Therefore, I will make Samaria a heap of rubble, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour her stones into the valley and lay bare her foundations. All her idols will be broken to pieces. All her temple gifts will be burned with fire. I'll destroy all her images, since she gathered her gifts from the wages of prostitutes. As the wages of prostitutes, they'll be used again. Okay, that's the announcement of judgment, specifically the fall of Samaria. Now you have, those are Micah speaking God's words as if he's maybe hearing them for the first time. Whoa! And now here's Micah's response. Because of this, I will weep and wail. I will go about barefoot and naked. I will howl like a jackal and moan like an owl. For her wound, Samaria's, is incurable. It has come to Judah. Again, now you're going to see the transference of Samaria is going to fall, but her sin has now manifested also in Judah. But Samaria is incurable. For her wound is incurable. It has come to Judah. It has reached the very gate of my people, even to Jerusalem itself. So he's talking about Samaria, but he's looking saying, we're in the same position. So here's an example of someone looking at Samaria's destruction and saying, this is bad, and they're coming down, but we're no different. We're next. And by telling the people that, as we know, it's going to have an effect on Judah. They're going to look at what happened to Samaria, and there's going to be, reluctantly, some revival. Her wound is incurable. It has come to Judah. It has reached the very gate of my people, even to Jerusalem itself. Now, that's where verse 8 and 9 is a breaking point between verse 9 and 10. Because now begins in verse 10, now begins a series of, like I said, 11 towns are mentioned. We're going to slow down and look at them. You can see them on the map on the back page. They're in the Shephelah. And here it is. It says right here. And I'll mention this because it's interesting. It begins with the phrase, verse 10, tell it not in Gath. Now that's exactly the way David began when Jonathan and Saul died. That is how David begins his lamentation. David begins his lamentation with the death of Saul and Jonathan. And it's I don't think this is a just a coincidence. It might be. I mean, this is, doesn't say that. But David, the glory of Israel, as Israel was falling in David's day and the king was killed, he says, tell it not in Gath. And then we're going to go through all these places, and the very last one that is going to be mentioned is in verse 15. It is in Adullam. And so this begins with a direct quote from David's lamentation, and ends with the city where David fled when he was a fugitive. He had to run and hide. He fled from King Saul. David was fleeing. So you've got David at a time of mourning. You've got David at a time of fleeing. It begins and ends. And then you're going to have 11 cities mentioned there. And their name of their city is going to have a word play that's going to, that Micah is going to build on, that's going to make a description of what's going to happen to them in this judgment. So in other words, we start with David during a time of mourning. We start with David during a time of fleeing. And that is that's like bookends of this time where Judah is going to mourn and Judah is going to have to flee. So here it goes. Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. In Beth Orphra, roll in the dust. Pass on in nakedness and shame, you who live in Shafir. Those who live in Zanan will not come out. And again, all these are fun, not funny, they're puns. Because Beth Esel, for example, means coming out. So another, Beth means house. Esel means come out. And so the house of coming out is in mourning. Excuse me. Zanan means come out. So those who live in come out will not come out because of the destruction. All this is detailed in the notes. I'll read through it correctly here in a moment. Beth Esel is in mourning. Its protection is taken from you. Those who live in Maoth writhe in pain, waiting for relief because disaster has come from the Lord even to the gate of Jerusalem. Notice Jerusalem does not fall. It comes up to the gate of Jerusalem, which is screaming 701 B.C. Because this is exactly this route right here. This is the way Sennacherib came down the coastal plain, moved through the Shephelah, and came up to Jerusalem. And then that the judgment came right up to the city wall or the city gate, and, well, it didn't manifest. You who live in Lachish, harness the team to the chariot. You were the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for the transgressions of Israel were found in you. Therefore, you will give parting gifts to Moresheth Gath, and that's Micah's hometown. The town of Akzib will prove deceptive to the kings of Israel. I will bring a conqueror against you who live in Mereshah. He who is the glory of Israel will come to Adullam, or, you know, the cave of Adullam. Shave your heads in mourning for the children in whom you delight. Make yourselves as bald as the vulture, for they will go from you into exile. So that's that chapter right there. And again, I think this section continues in the chapter 2 and 3 before we get to chapter 4 and we begin a different topic. So let's go ahead and look through this, looking first at those first seven verses. And you have a manifestation of God coming down after he calls the nations to come and be witness. So I'm on page 1 of the notes. And now in the English Standard Version, chapter 1, verse 2, hear you peoples, all of you, pay attention, O earth, and all that is in it, and let the Lord be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. In other words, from the temple, the Lord is providing some evidence that judgment is coming to the nations eventually. But first, the evidence is going to be what I'm about to do to my own people. And then, of course, you've got, I just put the interlinear in there if you wanted to kind of follow along. We'll use it a couple times tonight. And here's the points I write on page 2. The nations were summoned and the earth is called to witness. The world is to watch the Lord judge his own people. The world is to learn a lesson that their day of judgment will come. If God judges his own people, then definitely the world will face judgment. It's a teaching moment. Then point E, there you got it. 1 Peter 4, verse 17, judgment begins with the house of God. And then Micah 4, 11, verse 13, I'm going to read that real quickly, chapter 4, verse 11, verse 13. It says, but now many nations are gathered against you. They say, let her be defiled, let our eyes gloat over Zion. But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his plan. He who gathers them like sheaves to the threshing floor. So when the nations come against Israel, they're rejoicing about it, but they do not realize they're being brought in for judgment themselves. Rise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will give you the horns of iron, and I will give you the hoofs of bronze, and you will break to pieces many nations. Now, that's chapter 4. Now, we're in a different section. Chapters 1 through 3 is talking about the destruction of Israel with the nations watching. In chapter 4, as it begins, in the last days, Israel's going to be brought back, and now it's time for the nations to be judged, and the roles are going to be reversed, where Israel's going to judge the nations or bring judgment to the nations. Sennacherib could be the one that brings this judgment in 701 B.C., and the nations gather around Jerusalem, but now, in the future, it's going to be turned around, and so it's mentioned in there again. And Micah chapter 7, go to Micah chapter 7, verse 8 and 10. And this is an important point. Micah chapter 7, verses 8 and 10. This is the difference between God judging his people, the very term right there. God judging his people know God. They know God as creator. They know him as judge. They know him as savior. And his people will be judged, they'll be disciplined, but they will be restored. It happens in the Christian's life. A Christian is a child of God. They will go through discipline. They're never going to be cast out. They may go through discipline. We can see that all the way through Paul's writings, talking about, you know, the believer going through discipline. The believer is going to be disciplined in order to be brought back and restored. So they are his people. Now, if you are an unbeliever, or in this case, if you are the pagan nations and you do not know God, do you understand? When judgment comes, there's no hope. You have nowhere to turn. God is just coming and eliminating you. And so here it is in chapter, this is the distinction in chapter 7, verse 8. Do not gloat over me, my enemy. So in other words, the nations can be looking at God's people being disciplined, or in Micah's case, they're going to go through judgment. Do not gloat over me, my enemy. Though I have fallen, I will rise. Though I sit in darkness, the Lord will be my light. And you can see this many times in the Scriptures, even in David's life. When David sinned, he would come back, God would discipline him, but he would walk in the light of God again, wiser, stronger, and reestablished. Because I have sinned against him, I will bear the Lord's wrath until he pleads my case. That's interesting. I will bear Yahweh's wrath until he pleads my case. There you get your high priesthood of Jesus. We have an advocate before the Father. When we sin, he's there. 1 John, he's our advocate, even here. He will bring judgment, but that judgment will come until he pleads my case. It's not you pleading your own case, it's the Lord. Until he pleads my case and establishes my right. He will bring me out into the light. I will see his righteousness. And again, that's one of the purposes for discipline and judgment, is that we've gone into darkness and sin. We're fallen creatures. He brings us through this training, brings us through this discipline, so we can see his light, that we may be made righteous, not just by positionally, but actually in practice. He will bring me out into the light, and I will see his righteousness. Then my enemy will see it and will be covered with shame. She who said to me, "Where is the Lord your God?" My eyes will see her downfall. Even now she will be trampled underfoot like mire in the streets. In other words, these people, the people of God, will go through judgment, but they will be restored. And as these pagans mock and laugh, it's like, understand, when I'm restored, the judgment's going to begin here, but you will have nowhere to go. Now, again, in Christianity, in the church, our job is to call the pagan into this fellowship, the circle of fellowship, so that they can now be the people of God also. We see that in Romans. Those who were not his people are now called his people. And that's directly talking about the Gentiles being now able to have a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. It's no longer Israel or the nations, all people in Christ. So anyway, that's an interesting part of Micah right there. The nations are called together to watch this so they understand judgment is coming. Now, chapter 1, verse 3, I'm looking on the notes on page 2. For behold, the Lord is coming out of his place, and I will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth. This is very clear right here. Point 1, God is not only transcendent, meaning he's outside creation, he's immanent also. He can come in, appear, and be active in creation. So he's not just outside watching. When he's ready, he can come in, and in this case, he's coming in to bring judgment. A classic case was when he came in as the Son of God. He came in as a man himself. He wasn't just outside the eternal Son of God. The eternal Son of God took on flesh and actually entered time and was a man at a point in history. Now, if you look on your that transliteration box on chapter 1, verse 3, where is it at? It's the word bema. There it is. It's on the bottom line there. It's the second word in from the right where it says high places. It's the Hebrew word Bemot, which means high places, and you can see the Hebrew there if that's any help for you at all. But the vocabulary word for that word means height or summit. And in the way it's used, it says, "For behold, the Lord is coming out of his place, the temple, and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth," the Bemot of the earth, which would mean the heights, the summits. If you turn the page, you've got some more definitions. It is used to refer to a high place, you know, the summit, the top of a mountain. So God is coming down here like he came down on the top of Mount Sinai. But it is also used to refer to high places where God, the people would meet with God at a high place, which would be a pagan sanctuary. And that is, again, when it talks about the high places, Josiah, Hezekiah destroyed the high places. They were destroying the places that were set up to worship false gods or a false image of Yahweh, because you're supposed to worship in only one high place, and that was the temple. So again, it's interesting right there. The word is brought out right away. He comes down and treads the high place of the earth. That can be understood as he comes down in a figurative form to the top of the mountains to engage in history. But it can also refer that he's actually coming down to destroy these high places. But it goes on here, and in context, it's eventually going to mean that. Micah 1, verse 4, page 3. And the mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will split open like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. And again, what happens, he comes down and things begin to melt, fall apart. He's intervening in the physical world. Chapter 1, verse 5. All this coming down and all the destruction that manifests, all this is for, and I've got it underlined there on page 3. Notice the words, Jacob, Israel, Jacob, Samaria, and Judah, Jerusalem. So you've got Jacob and Israel being mentioned, but then you're going to go into two groups again, Samaria and Jerusalem are going to be identified. And before them it says, let's just read it. All this is for the transgression of Jacob. All this is for the sins of the house of Israel. So two words are mentioned, transgressions and sin. These are the two reasons, transgressions and sins. They may be, you know, redundant. They may be repetitive synonyms. Now they ask, what is the transgression of Jacob? The transgression of Jacob is Samaria. Samaria, the sin of Samaria is what is taking place in Samaria is what Jacob is guilty of. And we could say here, this would be social injustice. As we saw very clearly in the book of Amos, what is the sin of Jacob? It's Samaria. Well, what's going on in Samaria? Social injustice. They're oppressing the poor or destroying the middle class. Next it says, now watch this, and what is the, you would expect them to say, where it says, what is the transgression of Jacob? What is the transgression of Jacob? It's Samaria. Well, then you expect them to say, what is the sin of Judah? But it doesn't say what is the sin of Judah. Notice what it puts in there. What is the high place of Judah? In other words, it almost takes and as a synonym for sin, if it's following a poetic form, it would be what is the transgression of Samaria? What is the sin of Judah? But instead of saying sin, it says Bamoth. What is the high place? Because in Jerusalem or in Judah, the sin is false worship, or we'll just say idolatry. And idolatry, of course, is going to lead to social injustice. So just notice that right there. And what is the high place of Judah? Instead of saying what is the sin of Judah, it says what is the high place of Judah? And is it not Jerusalem? In other words, Jerusalem is not being called the seat of God Most High or the seat of the Holy One or the temple of Yahweh. Jerusalem is being called what? A high place. And so this is some of the stuff right here. If Micah is speaking in Jerusalem, this is the kind of stuff he's pronouncing, and everybody's going to see what takes place because of the sin of Samaria. And now he says, what is Jerusalem or Judah's sin or, you know, transgression? He says it's the high places. And this could have been the very thing that sparked Hezekiah to begin to dismantle all of his father Ahaz's high places, and that is exactly what he does. In fact, one that we saw in Arad. There's one in Arad, a high place, that's got the, you know, that we've talked about before. The two altars were found and incense altars, and an altar with the stone where they offered the sacrifices was still intact. The steps leading up to a little holy site or most holy place. When they excavated it, it wasn't buried in rubble where they had to take off layers and layers of archaeological, destruction layers. They got to this, and they got to just dirt. And that they basically had to do, they just had to dig through dirt, move the dirt off of it, and there it was. In other words, it wasn't just layers of history that covered it up like a tell would be, destruction layer. Some point in history, and they dated it, it was in the 700s. It was at this time. Someone came in and just moved dirt in and covered it up. It's gone. We planted a garden on it. It's gone. And it would probably be, at this time, it would probably be Hezekiah. And that was an example of a high place. It was almost like a little temple where they had false worship going on. And in the 700s, they came in and covered up. It's in the city of Arad. And, you just Google Arad. You can see it. You can see my pictures. But you can see everybody that's ever gone there. You can see their pictures. And so that is in Judah. Arad would be in Judah. And it is possible, as far as the timing, that they would have, Hezekiah would have covered that up after 722, while Micah's talking, while Isaiah's talking to him, after Samaria falls in 722 to the Assyrians, they take Micah's words to heart and they begin to cover up the high places that Ahaz had created. So, nonetheless, there's those verses there. I write some things at the bottom of the page, page 3 about that. Top of page 4, Micah 1:6, therefore I will make Samaria a heap in the open country. Now, we talked about Samaria and we talked about the high place of Judah, but it doesn't talk about what's going to happen to Jerusalem. That what takes place in this book, you're going to see the judgment and the enemy always getting to the gate. It even reaches, or the sin, just like the sin of Samaria reached the gate of Jerusalem, the enemy's going to reach the gate of Jerusalem, but there is never any destruction. That is left for another time. Because after Micah's ministry, Samaria is destroyed. Samaria is eliminated in 722 by the hand of the Assyrians. But Micah, like we said, had an impact on Jerusalem, as did Isaiah. And the enemy got to the gate, but because they had repented, Jerusalem was spared. Judah went through a lot of turmoil, the land did, but Jerusalem was spared, and it wasn't until 586, after the third captivity, if you would, it began in 605 with Nebuchadnezzar taking the royal children, which included Daniel, and then 595 with Ezekiel being taken captive, the second captivity, and then finally the third captivity and the destruction of the temple. So we're going to go from 701, when Sennacherib came, where Jerusalem is spared, up until 605, when one captivity, two captivities, and then the third captivity, and finally the destruction. So again, Micah's ministry is going to put pressure on Jerusalem, saying the enemy's going to come, it's going to be spared. But right here, what does take place, in the book of Micah, the only thing that happens to Jerusalem is it's approached by the enemy, and then it talks about it being restored in the later times. But now right here, the rest of these verses are right here, chapter 1, verse 6 on page 4, therefore, because of this sin, I will make Samaria a heap in the open country, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour down her stones into the valley. And the pouring down of the stones would be the idea of the stones of the walls, the buildings being knocked over and just rolling, tumbling down off the mount, you know, not mountain peak, but the high place, the hill of Samaria, tumbling down into the valleys. I will pour her stones into the valley and uncover her foundations. And the foundations would be the foundation stones that if you went to an archaeological site, a lot of times that's what you see, is the foundations, because everything else has been pushed off. So her foundation stones and the buildings have been pushed off into the valleys, and her foundation stones are there. That's what God is going to do to Samaria. Chapter 1, verse 7, all her carved images, these are religious images, will be beaten to pieces. And now what we're talking here is after they've attacked, they're going to take the valuable stuff. And if they have images, the carved images would be overlaid with gold. They'll be beaten to pieces, so they don't take the whole image back. They're not art collectors. They want the gold. They want the silver. Just like the artifacts in the temple, they were taken back, and many times they were just melted down. They were sawed apart. You can see them when they describe the destruction of the temple. Things are sawn apart, so they were smaller pieces, so they could take back to Babylon. Some of them, like the gold goblets and stuff, they are preserved. But in this way, they're beaten to pieces. And now watch this. All her wages shall be burned in fire, and all her idols I will lay waste. And again, they might be the burning of the fire, the wages that they earned and then presented to the gods, they're going to be burned in fire to melt the gold off, and then the idols will be thrown away, but the gold will be preserved. And then here, for from the fee of a prostitute she gathered them, and to the fee of a prostitute they shall return. Now that fee is going to refer to some kind of money. Now if we're talking about actual prostitution, that is going to be the prostitute was paid a fee and money was made, and that money then was used in some means, but this money that was spent in the society is going to be taken by the Assyrians, or the soldiers who are plundering it is going, this fee of prostitution is going to be taken by the Assyrians, and then the Assyrians will then spend it again. And how are they going to spend it? They're going to just recycle it and spend it on prostitutes. So that's what that could mean. For from the fee of a prostitute she gathered them, all this gold and money, that's where the Samaria got it, and to the fee of a prostitute they shall return. The soldiers are going to take it, and it's going to return to a prostitute. But that could be it. That could be the interpretation. But let's take this fee. It's going to be, the prostitute is not, in this case, or it could be, but it is now is going to be a false religion. We'll just say false religion. And the money they had, they're going to pay their offerings, their gold that they've worked for. They're going to pay the fee to a false religion. They're going to make their offering, their dedication. And this false religion is the prostitute. And you can see that throughout the prophets. You can see it in the book of Revelation. It's the typical image. If you're worshiping a false god, a false religion, and you claim to be a person of God, you are worshiping in a prostitute form. And so this is going to go to a false religion, the Samaritans. And what do they do with it? They take the gold, they put it into idols. They carve their images, and then they cover them with gold. So now they're in the sanctuaries. Well, here comes the Assyrians. The Assyrians are going to then plunder this gold. They're going to crush the idols. They're going to melt down the gold. The idols are going to pass through the fire. They're going to take this gold. They're going to take it back to Assyria, and they're going to spend it on prostitutes. Indeed, they could take this gold, and the soldiers just go out and buy a bunch of prostitutes with this gold, and now it's gone from a false religious system to the idols that were destroyed by the Assyrians, so they get the gold so they could buy prostitutes. Or, if we complete the circle, the Assyrian soldiers are to take it and dedicate it to their Assyrian gods in their Assyrian temples, which is also a false religion. So the fee that was given to the prostitute, a false religion, that was put in their idols, is melted down by the Assyrians, taken back and put back into a false religious system. Back from prostitute to prostitute, false religion to false religion. Again, that's what Mike is saying, and that's kind of what I point out there in that one point underneath there. I'll read it to you again in the English Standard Version. All of Samaria's carved images shall be beaten to pieces, broken down. All her wages shall be burned with fire. Her wages would have been the gold that she presented. They're going to be burned with fire, not to be destroyed, but to be melted and collected. Rome did the same thing. In fact, just an interesting historical thing, is sometimes the bricks, because the fire and the Romans burnt and collected the gold sometimes, obviously it liquefied, and dripped into stones. Even years after, people were going through the temple looking for gold that had melted, that had been, you know, fell in the cracks, or was, you know, on a little drop. Like in the shop, we solder, and we get done soldering. Oh, you know, I got 150 kids soldering during the day. And at the end of the day, you've got what? All over the tables. You've got drops of solder, a little silver on the floor, silver on the kids. You know, you got solder everywhere. Well, that same idea. They went through and they began to find little melted gold. And that's what they're talking about here. The wages shall be burned with fire, and all of her idols lay waste. They're going to be thrown away. We wanted the gold or the silver. For from the fee of a prostitute, for from the fee of false religion, she gathered them. And to the fee of a prostitute, a false religion, they're going to return. Okay, that is the judgment that is going to be taking place. You can see there's pretty clearly, if you look at it the way I'm presenting it, Samaria is coming down. Samaria's sin has reached even to the gates of Jerusalem, so Jerusalem's being warned, look out. So Samaria's gone, Jerusalem's being messed with by Micah, saying, you're in the same position. And the nations are supposed to be watching what's taking place. Okay, section 2. When Micah pronounces this, he says, for this I will lament and wail. Bottom of page 4, going to page 5. I will go stripped and naked. I will make lamentation like the jackals. And that means they're howling. And moaning like the ostriches. Again, that's the groaning and moaning sounds. Stripped and naked. Even Isaiah went stripped for 3 years, was stripped, went about naked. Again, there's a conversation, you know, was he like walking around publicly naked? it could be. Isaiah was doing it to show that there's going to be captivity. It's like, Isaiah, why'd you come to the meeting naked? Because you're all going off naked into captivity. What were you guys talking about? It's like he did it for 3 years. Now, however he did it, it was shocking. Maybe he just had a little pair of underwear on it, maybe a Speedo. I'm not sure what he was wearing. But it's enough for people to say, well, where's your clothes, man? It's like, well, because you're all going into captivity like this. They get something to eat? It's like, Isaiah, put some clothes on. Well, not until God tells me I can put my clothes back on. And so he was demonstrating with his nakedness captivity that was coming. It was a sign. But in this case, nakedness is going to be a sign of a mourning. How do you spell mourning? It's on the paper there. But anyway, he's going to be stripped and naked. These are all signs of mourning, that he's mourning what he's just pronounced. He himself is shocked. And again, I write that Micah laments and the predicted destruction of Samaria, wailing and unclothed, their sign of mourning. Isaiah, there it is, Isaiah 20, verses 2 through 3. You can read about it. And verse 9, why? For her wound is incurable. And as Samaria's wound is incurable, we can't fix Samaria. Samaria is done. God is wiping it out. And it has come to Judah. In other words, there is hope for Judah. Samaria is done. It's incurable. But it has infected Judah. Please find the remedy. It has reached to the gate of my people, Jerusalem. So he's in shock knowing what he just pronounced to Samaria. And then he looks over his shoulder and goes, oh my gosh, guys, we're doing the same thing. They're going down. If we don't change, I'm going to have to announce judgment on us too. And so he's shocked. Okay, now here we begin the wordplay of names. And what's going to take place here is, if we drew a map, here's the Mediterranean coast. Here's the coastland. Here's the Shephelah, the lowlands. Here's, again, Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Here's Jerusalem. They removed Jerusalem up a little bit. The cities we're talking about are going to be right in here, the lowlands, the Shephelah, right off. This is the mountain range. This is the hill country. And as it tapers down into the coastal plain, all these cities are right in this general area. When this takes place, this is, I think, is a prophecy of events that are going to take place. And in the 700s, there's like four different times it could have taken place. One, when Israel was fighting against Judah, and Israel got the Arameans to side with them to come put pressure on Judah during Ahaz's day, so that Judah would side with them in an anti-Assyrian coalition when Assyria was just rising in Tiglath-Pileser's day. They came down and they fought, and there were some battles taking place. So it could be during that time when Israel, the northern kingdom, the Arameans came against Judah. It could also be around 712. By this time, the Assyrians have regained. They've already destroyed, 722, of course, Israel falls. There was some revolt. It could be during that time where they came down and tapered down into here, around 722. There's a time where Gath, they came down and put pressure on the Philistines. I think that was 712. So the Assyrians came down into this area and made some attacks. But the other one would be 701, when Sennacherib comes down and marches through all these cities, even Lachish, which is mentioned here. That is, like we've talked about, that is what was on his palace walls. This is his palace walls from Nineveh, after 701, are in the British Museum. And the wall goes around. This whole siege of Lachish is documented on Sennacherib's walls. So he came down right down the coastal plain, came right into the Shephelah, and took these cities. And as you know, as he worked his way through them, he made his way up to Jerusalem. So I do not know. No one knows for sure. You've got to kind of figure it out. But this is an example. It could be when they came down and put down a Philistine revolt. It could be when the Assyrians came down and destroyed Samaria. It could be Israel fighting against Judah. Or it could be 701, which matches perfectly. But here it is. The wordplay. And I've got them underlined. I've got the words. And you can do two things here. And I'll probably do both of them if I hurry. If you look on the back page, let's do that first, and then I'll read through the notes. You can see I've got the Shephelah written on there, the coastal plain. And the army would have came down the coastal plain and then came down to right around Gath. We know where Gath is at. That's point one. Shephir is three. We know where that's at. We do not know where 2, 4, 5, and 6 are. And so most likely they're in that same area. But that's not guaranteed. It could be anywhere on the map. But it really wouldn't make sense. You've got to somehow make sense of what is being said here. Because they're going from Gath, working their way to Adullam. So if you go from point one Gath, which is absolutely correct, they've excavated it. In fact, when we were at Azekah, you can look out from the tell of Azekah and look to one area and see where David fought Goliath. Go to the other side of the tell and look the other way, and you can see Gath. You can see the tell, the dome of Gath, right from Azekah. And you can see where Azekah is. So it progresses from Gath, and then eventually goes to Lachish, then to Moresheth Gath. It mentions Akazib, then it mentions Mereshah, and then finally it mentions Adullam, and then it mentions that it's at the gate of Jerusalem. So you kind of see the progression from Gath to Adullam. You see what I'm saying? That's the way it seems to be written. It doesn't have to be exactly the same, but it would be weird if number 2, 4, 5, and 6, one was down south of Beersheba, one was over in Gilead, one was up north of Megiddo. You know, it wouldn't make sense. You'd have to come up with another answer. But nonetheless, you can see the cities. I've got question marks by one we don't know where they're at, and they're in a light circle. Gath sounds like the word tell. Beth La Ophrah. Ophrah, it means Beth. Always remember, Beth means house or house of, like Bethlehem, house of bread. So Bethlehem means the house of bread. Ophrah or Ophrah means dust. So Beth La Ophrah means house of dust. Then Shafir means beautiful. We'll get some more details on it. Zainan means come out or to go forth. Beth Ezel, again, Beth means house of taking away. Moroth means bitter. Lachish, it means to the steeds or the horses, referring to chariot horses. Moresheth Gath means one who is betrothed. So it refers to, the word is like the woman, the bride, the one who is betrothed. And that we'll play with that here in a moment. Akzib means deception. Meresheth means conqueror. So probably Meresheth, point 10, was named, after someone had conquered it, you know, conquered. It was maybe a Canaanite city, and it was conquered, and then they renamed the city, the conquered city. And we're going to look at that, and then Adullam. So now we go back to the notes. You can look at that or go to page 5 of the notes. Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. And if you look at the notes underneath there, Gath, it means, the word gat is similar to the Hebrew word that means or sounds like the word tell. So, and then it says, weep not at all. So they don't even want Gath to know about it. Tell it not in Gath, don't talk about it, don't even weep. Let's just pretend this did not happen. And then Beth La Ophrah, which means house of dust. You see that? It says, tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. Beth La Ophrah, or house of dust. It says, roll yourself in the dust. So a house of dust, start rolling in the dust. It goes on, verse 11. Pass on your way, inhabitants of Shafir. And if you look at point 1 underneath that on page 7, Shafir means beautiful, fair, or pleasant. But it says, pass on your way, inhabitants of Shafir, in nakedness and shame. So the Shafir means beautiful, the fair, the pleasant place. You're going to be just the opposite, naked and shame. Not beautiful, you're naked. The inhabitants of Zainan, and Zainan, as we mentioned, means come out. To the inhabitants of come out, do not come out. You won't be able to get out of your city. You're surrounded. So we come out, we can go and do things. No, those of you who come out, don't come out. You can't. And then the inhabitants of Zainan, do not come out. The lamentation of Beth Ezel shall take away from you its standing place. Now, if you look at Beth Ezel, Beth means house. Ezel means beside or adjoining. The house of beside, the house of joining. So it would appear, the idea there, they're trying to work with what he's saying, is that it is a place that is adjoined to Jerusalem. In other words, once you get here, you can see Jerusalem. You're adjoined to Jerusalem. But it says right here, the lamentation of Beth Ezel, or the house that is joined aligned with Jerusalem shall be taken away from you its standing place. In other words, you are no longer aligned. You've been taken captive. You've been dispersed. You can no longer say, ah, we're right beside Jerusalem. No, you're not. You're in another country. Chapter 1, verse 12. For the inhabitants of Maroth wait anxiously for good because disaster has come down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. And Maroth means bitter. For the inhabitants of Bitter wait anxiously for good. Is something good going to happen? No. Disaster has gone right past you. It's already at the gate. Nothing good is coming. No deliverance is coming because it's gone right past you. And as now it's up at the gate of Jerusalem, there's no hope. Because disaster has come down from the Lord. Again, identifies where this disaster, it may be the Assyrians, but Mike is hooking it right up to the Lord. The Lord is bringing this disaster right up to the gate of Jerusalem. Harness the steeds to the chariots, inhabitants of Lachish. And again, it means steeds. And in other words, hook up your chariots because you're going to try to get away. They're not going to war. They're trying to flee. It was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for in you were found the transgressions of Israel. Remember how the Israel's sin is going to be destroyed, but it's come to the gate of Jerusalem? It came apparently from Israel in the north to Lachish and progressed into, and it may be the chariots. That may be part of it. Lachish means to flee. Then, therefore, you shall give parting gifts to Moresheth Gath. And if you remember, Moresheth Gath means betrothed. It means it's the bride that's being given away. One family is giving away the bride, and she's going to another family. But she's usually given parting gifts. As she goes away, she's given some things that go with her. And so in this case right here, therefore you shall give parting gifts to Moresheth Gath. Because Moresheth Gath is going away. Just like a bride is going away, so is Moresheth Gath. They're not going, they are. They're going to another husband. They're going to the Assyrians. The houses of Achzib shall be a deceitful thing to the kings of Israel. And Achzib means the deceit. I have nothing for that. Meresheth, the inhabitants of Meresheth, the glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. Did I miss something? Yeah, I will again bring a conqueror to you. So Meresheth. Remember, Meresheth means conqueror. Someone conquered Meresheth, and they're proud of the fact that we conquered it. Well, now the conquered, the city that was, you know, honor of the one who conquered it, you're going to be conquered. And that's Meresheth. Or the Hebrew root word means to possess, and a new possessor is coming. And then it ends with, shall the glory of Israel, which could be David, it could be the people of Israel, it could be, you know, the hope of Israel, it's going to come to Adullam. And who came to Adullam? David came to Adullam when he was fleeing, when he was hiding. And so Israel, all of Israel is going to do the same thing David did. They're going to start fleeing. I think that's why Adullam's there. The place where David fled, now the best of Israel is going to do the same thing. All that's left of Israel, what's left of Israel? Fleeing, running for your lives. Then to the final verse, make yourselves bald. What is being said right there? Well, here's what he's being said. Make yourself bald and cut off your hair. That's a sign of mourning. For the children of your delight. In other words, they're hoping for another generation. They're hoping to occupy their cities and occupy their lands, hand the inheritance to the children. They're going to hand the traditions to the children. No, never mind. You're not going to. Shave yourselves, cut off your hair for your children of your delight. Make yourselves as bald as an eagle, for they, your children, the children of your delight, are not going to receive an inheritance. They're not going to continue the traditions. They shall go from you into exile. And so the whole point of going down that map was just a creative way for him to address all these cities, make it very personal for every one of those cities in the Shephelah that you're going to be overrun. You're going to be overrun. You won't even be able to come out. You're going to get a parting gift as you go to another family because you're going to the Assyrian family. All I'm talking about, he's saying, is you're not going to have another generation. Your children that you're going to hand stuff that you're not going to hand to the next generation. They're going to be gone. They're going into exile. And that ends chapter 1, and you can see the three parts right there. Samaria is definitely falling. He weeps in verse 8 and 9, mourns, because not just because of Samaria, but he realizes what's going to take place in Samaria could likely take place in Judah. So now he addresses Judah about all the cities in the Shephelah as something's going to take place, and judgment is going to march right through those cities, and they're all going into exile. And in fact, all those cities that we just mentioned, in 701, all those cities were taken captive. In fact, on the palace walls of Sennacherib that are in the British Museum, you can see as they're shooting stones and they're archers are shooting and there's battles going on and people are being flayed. You know, they're stretched out and being skinned alive. There's people that are going off on the other parts of the city. They're in chariots, not chariots, they're in carts. The men are carrying backpacks, heavy loaded backpacks, and the women are driving carts with oxen pulling them on this image of Lachish that's up in Nineveh, now in the British Museum. It goes as long as this wall, across that back wall, and back up this way. And you just watch the whole sea, just like action photos of the whole thing. And people are leaving as people are dying and fighting battles. People are also going out the base of the city, going off. And where are they going? These are the children going into exile. The women are driving carts being pulled by oxen or something with little children with all kinds of luggage in it. And the men are walking, carrying luggage. They're taking their belongings because they're being taken to, just like the Bible says, they're being exiled to another land. And somebody else is going to be brought in by the Assyrians to live in their land. And so that's probably what that is talking about, because it sure fits. Again, we don't know for sure, but we definitely have that. We know the time period, we know the king, we know the situation. And, you know, without having an absolute date on there, you're pretty much nailing it with that information. I will start on chapter 2 next week. Are there any questions before I pray? I mean, that's another two-hour conversation, I'm sure. But is anything you want to say, something that I missed that's important, like I spelled a word wrong or something, which would be obvious. Otherwise, thank you for coming. I'll pray and we're free to go. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we would, again, take these things to heart. We ask that we may somehow shine a light in our country, just like Micah did in his country, that we'd see the signs around us that look what could happen or what has happened, and that we'd see people make strides to turn back to righteousness. We ask that we would be able to identify our false religions and our idolatry, and our misuse of twisted theology, and come back to the truth as individuals and as a culture. Again, Father, we do thank you for this opportunity to hear your word at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.